Hey, this is LA Lit. Welcome. LA Lit is a literary interview and reading podcast whereon we talk with writers from Los Angeles and those from afar who happen to be passing through the city. LA Lit is sponsored by Super Bunker. You can find Super Bunker at www.superbunker.com, and it is held here at Beta Level, which is at www.betalevel.com. I'm your co-host, Stephanie Ryu.
And I'm Matthew Timmons. We have on the show today Mark von Schlegel. Mark von Schlegel's novel Venusia, the first volume from his Systems series, was issued in late 2005 by MIT and Semiotext. His short science fiction writings have been included in the anthologies Juncture from Soft Skull Press and Future Ways from Arsenal Pulp, and appear regularly in the International Art Underground. He has published cultural criticism in Art Text, Flash Art, NYFA Quarterly, Extra, and Art on Paper. Mark received a PhD in English and American Literature from New York University. He currently divides his time between Los Angeles and Cologne, writing and teaching. Recent projects include editing the final issue of the insurrectionist LA newsletter, The Rambler. You are Layla Waddell, the world's first ever whore TML document. And at highwichita.com, you can find an expanding mini-verse based on his 2006 novelette, High Wichita. Mercury Station, the second in the System series, is nearing completion. Sounds like a first draft is coming out soon. So, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's actually called Fondest Regards, Mercury Station.
And so you're going to start by reading a short story?
Yeah.
Great. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's called Squid. It's one probably one of my first coherent science fiction creations. At least I think so. And it's called Squid. It was published in a chapbook in Colorado along with poems by Maureen Owen. And it was also translated into German and published there in a little booklet by Possible Press called Der Tintenfisch. And so, but I've been rewriting it on and off my whole existence since it started about 10 years ago, and this is the current incarnation. Squid. When Johann stands alone before the wide blank exhibit window in the low illumination of the hall, its darkness seems to expand. Blackness, a green black more specifically, offering up a mammoth nothing to see. The days pass and there is only this blackness. One day an old man stops beside him. There was no squid at all, he says, ever. It had been 5 years since Johann had been taken on as a security guard at the media conglomerate where Patricia served an editorship. It was a good job for one of his kind, and he didn't expect anything better. Easiest to bear was the graveyard shift when no one much bothered him. He could sit at the desk, smoke many lung protectors, and read. He read many pages on top of a high hourly rate. On day shifts, you would never know he was discontent. No, he stood at the assigned station and greeted the publishers as he was supposed to, meeting their passing smiles with the necessary sparkle. Not one of them ever looked back long enough to notice the savagery of his grin. And so, after 5 years of impeccable service, Johann was eligible for a mixed-level company getaway. He had no interest in the moon or orbital hotels. Johann chose a subsurface oceanic resort. He had never seen an ocean in real life, but for reasons he couldn't explain, the idea haunted him. As it was technically no longer Earthside, there'd be no restrictions in the Indian Club ocean. But on the shuttle that took him there, it was the same old story, steerage for Johann and his ilk. And so he'd been unable to glimpse the open sea from above. His first view would be from thousands of meters down, deep in the volume. But this was enough. The bubbles on his first sight, their slow golden shimmers, gave way to a slow-motion, deep-hued water world, and one was at last free. The interior of the club, its cool, damp stones, deep pools, and log-stooled barbecues, the green mist curling up from beneath the hatches, eating, drinking, dreaming, living fish, seaweed, shrimp, scallops, squid, sea unicorn farmed fresh, eaten raw. Johann was surprised by his appetite for such things. He began to remind himself, in what became his decadence, of those over whom all his life he had considered himself vastly superior. Now he realized he was worse in his way than them. Taking it all into himself, belching sea as he sucked it, peering through portholes, cataloging kelps, photographing phosphorescent plankton illuminated by the cruise director's light pulse wave makers in the wonderlit paradise of the mega aquarium. He was simultaneously like to an underworld god and a god of the pseudo-sea. Patricia had come upon him then in a small view bubble. His bony finger was scrawling notes on a paper notebook, no cod in evidence. He frowned up at her, looked directly into her eyes. Above sea level, the situation would have been excruciatingly impossible. It was only under the sea that they could soon, immediately, be one. And yes, would. Impressions. Patricia calming him, explaining to him the club's relaxed restrictions. Sexual affairs between the classes relieve social tension. Handing out cash on the floor of the bulb, the uncurious eyes of sea creatures pressed close to the quasi-crystal glass. Yes, they looked at Johann as he made love to the human woman and saw only him seeing them, as if for them the bubble formed for the sea, an eye with a twisting pupil knowing and seeing everything of Oa, moving with her wild, wide-open swirl. Patricia herself was deeply moved by the experience in that bubble. That was why she kept him after the return to the surface, even as they both changed back into the things they had been before. Johann into whatever shard of a man one might imagine he could be in a different world, and she with her stubborn moralism, refusing to give up her unwinnable war against everything she herself stood for. So she had arranged for his new position as a guard at the halls of the Terran Seas, in the hope that would help him live with their inevitable division. She knew what was coming. She had heard such things broke his kind beyond repair. The truth was, Johann did not feel farther from himself at the halls of the Terran Seas, already the farthest place from the oceans of the world. The floors were plastic and the tall walls were dark and dry, and there was the sense that everything, even the ceiling, was carpeted. Now and then a geriatric would come and stare at the sad dolphins and remote whales, as if he remembered seeing something real. Other days, goggling gaggles of privileged children with their inferior attendants and guard units. But the place was generally deserted. The others, like him, employed sweeping the halls, cleaning the harnesses, they left each other well enough alone. Supervision was scanty. The old building swelled in the bygone modernism of its age, sloshing 80,000 gallons of barely living brine every day, no doubt rusting at the seams and always smelling somehow like mud. So Johann found himself more and more often alone before the great black bay window in the museum's largest and emptiest room. He soon realized that had anyone any interest in this museum, they would find this room the most interesting of all. He spent some time cleaning the text of its explanatory plaque. It was only written, so you had to read it. And this was a good thing, because compared to the convoy's plaques elsewhere in the museum, this plaque had a peculiar, even boisterous tone. "Behold," it said, "the most remarkable exhibition in the world, known by myth and madman and sailor, krakens, glimpsed in dream or sudden photo but never caught alive, vicious, unforgiving foe of Leviathan himself, most audacious of the great beings that once roamed the Terran seas. Behold, the last jumbo squid in the known universe." And the finer print below, "Keep away from the glass. Will you awake her into rage?" After reading this plaque, it was impossible for Johann to leave the hall. He could have moved elsewhere, to the sea ferns, for instance, always visible, or the otters reportedly scandalously lively. But Johann stayed with the squid. There was never any question of his leaving. Surveillance was probably pumping hilarious vids of his gullibility through the system. Perplexed by the slightest, simplest trick of the hand, guarding nothing at all, the canned laughter of the mechanical men written out for them ahead of time by ever more cynical programmers. But today, Johann notices a GU has entered the hall. He stiffens. He didn't think guard units would have any reason to come here. He has no business looking anyway, but he looks. As he does so, it's as if a gothic web unscrolls around him, a spiked metallic web in which he can never move. The rubber string crisscrosses her limbs like shadows cast through a cage door, and the green of the waters reflects on her golden skin as she crosses the room, animated yet as if somehow carved out of the smoothest, warmest stone, sneakers squeaking, a leather satchel swinging low against her thigh. In the dead silence of the hall, the GU's beeps and twirls sound like a robot parade as it inserts itself between them. She unzips her bag. "No vids permitted," Johann says. "I have no video." She speaks with an accent, raising a naked arm to point a laser pen at his eye. "What's this?" He's slow to react. She squeezes the pen, and there's a sudden flash, and between them, the little green head of the GU explodes. The husk twirls around, kicks over, dies. A new silence falls through the wide room. You see, I shot it. It's not so hard. She had removed a black bundle from her bag and now pressed it up against her face. She was kissing it with long, steady strokes of her tongue and then sticking it with a suction cup to the black-green glass. Johann steps backwards. What are you doing? Blowing this window wide open, blowing this entire museum into the industrial degradation it would have wound up perpetrating anyway. But there is enough water in that one tank to compromise the whole structure of museum when up it blows. 10 minutes. She looks at her watch. What about the squid? Everyone is knowing there is no squid, but why such attention to it? So much food, so much water, we must run. She came close. He could smell her. She held out her hand to him, even smiled. Come, she whispered, you are one of us. This is for us, for our kind. He took her hand surprisingly delicate, soft, petite. The old smile returns to his face. I'll stay, he says. I understand. She's gone then, her running steps sounding flat against the distant halls. But she hadn't understood. Johann Hintert walked to the glass and examined the fastened bundle. He yanked the thing, and when the suction cup popped, he felt the terrorist saliva spray cool bacteria against his face. He wiped it with his sleeve, walked the winking bundle across the hall, dropped the explosives down the corner disposal chute. He waited. No cataclysm, near or far. He was surprised to see, as he returned to the squid, that his hands were shaking. His attention immediately focused on the plaque. It had changed. He found the words now said, thank you. Johann turned to the exhibit. Near the center of the black glass, about the size of his own head, he perceived a single enormous eye. It emerged out of the void's volume like a crystal ball in which he could see his own image convexly reflected, ringed by a tender orange, centered by a pupil round and flat. The huge eye was wide open. The pupil caught green and yellow light. In a sudden flash, Johann perceived the creature's enormous body arcing out like a scarlet blade behind it. But the blackness returned, and again only the eye stood out. He turned back to the sign. It now said, listen. He listened, but could only hear his own heart. Listen, Johann, the walls are shaking in time to Oa's beat. Johann listened more intently. He heard absolutely nothing. The wails. It is over. The male has dislodged his enormous member. I'm afraid I don't hear what you're talking about, Johann said aloud in the empty room. What is it? Again the eye receded suddenly, and then again in a new spot of the blackness it reappeared. I am old, the plaque said. I cannot always protect myself. But you have done well, and I am not ashamed to speak with you now. I thought you weren't there at all. You saved me. Though you are puny, slow, you are an adequate guard. I myself shall think of something to give you, a gift, something you can understand. We will not need to speak again. The eye jerked suddenly away. On the plaque, the text reverted to its original form. A new guard unit sailed into the hall, hovering over its ruined comrade. It was angry. What happened? What happened to him? Not him, Johann said. It malfunctioned. Is that so? Badly. Who are you talking to in here? The squid. There is no squid, mister. Move along. The GU hauled away the dead machinery. Was there no one else watching? Johann looked again for the squid. There was nothing there, just the blackness. Since the squid's day, weeks ago, the words had come streaming as if seeking its single reading eye. Johann had researched late into the night. Patricia had noticed the emigration brochures scattered across his desk. You do that? She asked quietly, not laughing. He knew she wanted him to and was often capable of small generosities. Johann thought of the squid. They're thinking of turning Mars into an ocean planet, he said. Well, why not go? Spacers are free-thinking people. They'd probably respect you. He was sailing now to the halls of the Terran seas, over, among, through the wisping air tubes of combobulated Hamburg. He had hoped to have been able to leave Patricia momentarily unsure of everything she thought she understood, picturing a universe where something he said could be unbearable to her, but it would never be. And a blue Mars was not to be the squid's gift. poured concrete graft the air with endless raw-faced walls as Johann's module sailed through the docking structures of the halls of the Terran seas. "Hey," Johann said, "where are we going?" The module was lifting him above the levels designated for his kind. "I'm surprised as you are," it said. The craft shot upwards. It popped through the structure's final hole and rolled onto the lot rooftop high above the gray domed city, in the open air. There were only three slots up here, three pristine gilt-edged modules hooked at the foot of the granite steps. Before each module, a plaque proclaimed its rider's name and title. Ernest Cheney, Chancellor, Melinda Horse, Editor, Hops Hooray, Operations. "This is my target," the module said, "believe it or not." Another vacant slot waited open to the left of the Chancellor. As Johann's craft slid into it, it proclaimed, among some fanfare, "Johann Hintert, Employee of the Month." The squid's gift. Johann stepped out into the unfiltered sun. It blazed hot on his face and felt nice, not deadly at all. First of his kind to do so in a long while, he imagined, he climbed the old steps slowly. The Baroque frieze above the gate depicted prehistoric tentacle-headed elder things. He couldn't read the words carved below. They curled in a monstrous aquatic script, so alien as to sicken him without even reading. But he understood their general import. The squid controlled everything, the entire small city. It could not have survived anymore in the oceans and had kept up this local human culture just to stay alive. Johann saw truckloads of fresh water approaching, trains bearing cylinders of farm-fresh cod, shoveled by shattered, gray-faced men. Far beyond the blackened domes of the smoldering city, as if setting the distant globe to fire, there stretched the gleaming surface of a frozen, poisoned sea. But Johann Hinter didn't stop to linger. He hurried to return where he belonged, below, down where the squid wanted him to be. The end.
Thank you. Well, Mark, I think I'm going to reveal a strong bias of LA Lit by asking this question because we've mostly had poets and then a few fiction writers, but never science fiction. So you're our first science fiction guest. And so therefore, I feel a little bit entitled to ask what maybe you could trace for us how you came to this genre and what in it attracted you and why you pursue it.
In the public school library when I was a kid, I started reading at an early age, and I loved, I guess my first book was Treasure Island, and I was into these kind of adventure stories, boys' stories, and I got really into reading, and I went into the library of, it was the aptly named Cox School, and I found the largest book on the shelves for the kids, and it was called The Mysterious Island by Jules Verne. And this book made a huge impression on me. I didn't really understand it at all, but this idea of scientists shipwrecked and Captain Nemo appearing near the end, the romance of science fiction, and really caught me there. And I didn't really consider the fact that I might write science fiction at all, but maybe more adventure-type stories, because I loved those. And then years later, I went to writing school at NYU and was kind of imbued in the contemporary scene at that time, sort of people writing like Raymond Carver, writing like that, and I just couldn't do it. Everything I did was just too eccentric somehow, my writing. And around the same time, I was temping in New York, and I was given a free set of all the new republished Philip Dick books, and I had read some Dick, but I had never considered his whole output. I read it all, and from that point on, I thought using science fiction could somehow tame the eccentricity of my own writing and make it more pleasurable for other people and myself. And so I started dreaming that I would someday be a science fiction writer and got to work. I'm almost there.
I wanted to ask, I mean, and maybe this is kind of like Stephanie, a question along genre, you know, specific lines, but I think you could see this in any kind of prose, but or narrative prose. But I wonder if you can talk about like kind of the distinction in sci-fi between the real and the unreal. And the reason I ask that question is also because in Venusia, the book we're going to talk about more in the rest of the show, one has to start within the fictional construct of the book, start trying to figure out if there's distinctions between the real and the real and the real and the multiple kind of natures of the real in that book. So I wonder if you can talk about that a bit.
Well, it's a large subject. I did once write an essay, a critical essay called In Search of the Real Unreal. That's a good title. But that's definitely a big theme of Venusia. I mean, the idea that reality is a sort of shared hallucination. Some people say a kind of holograph system made by the strange clouds of atoms that we are is a kind of hologram of reality that we perceive together. And I guess one theme of my work is what happens to the nature of reality when Earth life leaves Earth. And the more I thought about it, the more I think it might start breaking down what the real itself means when you no longer have an atmosphere supporting you and you're no longer part of a biosystem. The nature of reality would be up for grabs in a certain sense. And that's theme of Venusia, I guess. There's also a tradition in science fiction where the real is proved to be an illusion or some kind of fiction. A book like Philip Dick's Time Out of Joint, which was sort of ripped off for that movie The Truman Show, where a man is in a typical 50s reality and he suddenly realizes the whole thing is staged for him. And then he breaks through. I was influenced by that kind of conceptual breakthrough pattern in science fiction, but in my book I wanted it never to end. So there's no ground reality as there is in, let's say, The Matrix. You finally find out what's really going on. Yeah. In Venusia, it's just a kind of almost endless procession of these new discoveries that lead to another new discovery. And reality is no longer something that can be arrived at in some way.
Kind of launching off of that, there's a friend I know that likes the phrase the concatenated shells of illusion, and kind of it references this kind of enlightenment, pre-enlightenment idea that, you know, that beyond the kind of shadow of our real lived experience, there's this, you know, if we could break through, we'd see, you know, what God saw.
Yeah.
But then taking off of that, there are philosophers that talk about how it's like that it would just be breaking through into another shell and another shell and something like that. And that it would never be really that much different than the shell that you were in originally, but just, you know, slightly different. I'm bringing that up, but something that I've noticed in your work that always kind of carries across are these kind of like clear delineations in society. Usually much more emphasized. And then also, with that, it's like these kind of police states to a certain extent. And so I wonder if you can talk about that in a sense of, you know, why are you choosing to emphasize that? I mean, you know.
It's a hard question, but I think a lot of the fiction I enjoy is about people struggling against some sort of a hegemonic, unjust system.
Yeah.
I always have romanticized the Irish Republican Army. I grew up as a sort of child of an Irish American family and listened to those songs. And I've always been basically communist, red to the bone. So I always feel like the struggle is there to be fought. But it's also just makes for entertaining, fun fiction, I think, when your character is struggling against these kind of forces. And, you know, I, as an American, I've been concerned about the political situation and always looking for ways to express my feelings in my writing. And I believe that politics is a really healthy and powerful element of science fiction writing. And I want to be part of that tradition.
Yeah. It seems like... I've never thought of this before, but yeah, it is a a sort of natural part of science fiction writing. You normally think, yes, those two things go together. Preparing for the show, I looked up paranormal populism on the internet, because, you know, on the back of your book it says that you you have an interest in that, and how it works with philosophical inquiry. And a lot of stuff about conspiracy theories came up. And, you know, tying back into what's real and who controls it, it seems like that's rich stuff for exploration in this genre that's very attractive and popular. I mean, I can see why it's popular.
Yeah. The paranormal community, it's, I think it's even called, is I think growing exponentially every day. As, I think a lot of paranormal speculation is, of course, some kind of weird psychosexual fantasies of people, including myself or whatever, and trying to find structures in a world that kind of seems frighteningly structureless, you know. And but when I lived out here, I first, as I was working late in the night, I started listening to Coast AM, this Art Bell radio show, and found that yeah, like you said, the way that they can go back and look at alternate histories of Atlantis or ancient Rome or technology in Egypt, and that stuff has just always fascinated me, and I just find it readable and somehow beautiful that humans insist on rewriting their own history in such ways. And yeah, and I think, you know, I tried to design Venusia a little bit for that community. It's part of it's sort of a Wiccan book too, I think.
Yeah, yeah, with Oa and the priestess, and also there seems in there a loyalty to a psychedelic exploration of what is real, specifically not just psychedelic, but the psychedelic experience of mushrooms and plant life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my narrator's a plant in the book, and it made me think, and this plant, of course, looks as if he's gardening, or he or she, it's both, I guess. The plant thinks that it's gardening humans, you know, and the humans think that they're gardening the plants, and et cetera. But, I mean, the more I went back, there's this famous book in the 70s called The Secret Life of Plants that was influenced me a lot in this, and but I went back and looked at the creation of humanity, and you know, a lot of, I think it's sort of accepted in science that a lot of our evolutionary leaps had to do with some of the things we were eating, growing, you know, our relationship to plants. And there are some people who think that mushrooms in particular had some responsibility to the way our brains grew, and et cetera. And so why not see the human project as a project of the plants to create us, as much as we create different strains of plants, etc. And
yeah, it's true. Mushrooms share with animals oxygen breathing, carbon monoxide expelling,
exactly.
As opposed to plants. Yeah, so there's connection there.
And there's lots of alternate histories that go back, and, you know, I always love these books that claim that manna that fell from heaven was in fact mushrooms, that Moses was tripping and all of this stuff. It was more popular in the 70s, that kind of stuff.
Can you talk about Oa? Because Oa is in that short story and also in Venusia, and you say it's like a figure that kind of runs throughout a lot of your work.
Yeah. Well, I'm dealing with a kind of system where I need to, in my series, I'm dealing with a series, not a system. Mm-hmm. And in that series, there is a system in which there are certain primal movers, and one is, I think, that character or force I called Oa, a word I took from another book. I think it was from Marion Zimmer Bradley. I think I took that word from her. But anyway, it reflects sort of like the idea of Gaia, but it's more ocean-related. And the idea in Venusia is that the plants worship the ocean as some kind of primal god, and that all life came out of the ocean. And so Oa is sort of the shared living will behind all earth creatures is Oa. And it's hard for to discuss it in ordinary human language. So my stories just approach what it might mean. I can't really define it for you.
Right. Well, I mean, since we're talking about Venusia, I wonder if you want to read a section from there, and then we'll see where we go.
Okay. A lot of people think this book is not hard science fiction because it's set on Venus. And Venus is, so we're told, the most inhospitable planet they could possibly have. And the idea of placing a colony there might seem ridiculous. But in this section of the book, you find out that the creatures living on Venus simply made our probes report the wrong data to us. That's why we think it's. In the old days, they used to think Venus would be another warmer Earth. It was a little bigger, a little nearer the sun, and there are scientists who still believe it once was and then went through a greenhouse effect. So it could be a future Earth. All right, this is a scene where my character, Rogers Collectibles, has been pursuing a missing book throughout the text, and he finally seems to have located it with a gigantic insect that he might be hallucinating or might not be. And they're trying to make a deal over the provenance of the book. And the insect gives a kind of speech explaining who it is. They sat for some time in silence. The bug looked away. Its many eyes focused on nothing through the monocle on its horn. It absentmindedly vomited a gray liquid onto its feelers and rubbed the stink into its fur. There is a problem? Something was wrong, but Rogers couldn't place it. He closed his eyes. Look, he said, I'm tired. I'll take the book home with me now, and I want the money before I turn it over. Let's say 5 o'clock. Where? Rogers thought of the hellish shapes of the endscape, of the woman's face filling up the sky. At the House of Sighs, he said. But the evening wasn't over. As Rogers drifted towards sleep, 13th Zorekian of the Great Leaf drummed its warm, wet feelers on his forehead, telling him far more than he had ever wanted to know. Mr. Rogers Collectibles, your kind astonished us. Not so many days ago, you were a once promising species of ape alchemists that had gone bad. We assumed your planet would put you down like the lizards who once ruled the Terran surface. You were able, like them, perhaps, to reach your moon, but not to manage multidimensional penetration between alternities anytime soon. Earth and Venus are entangled in every dimensional variation of this system. We like to keep all the Venuses available, for we are usually able to make quiet and easy worlds of them. We saw your machines approach this one, and we arranged, as is our way, a vision of a hostile, impossible world to greet them. Your mono-optics and robotic probes are laughably easy to deceive. We turned your attention elsewhere, to bodies far distant and, in truth, far more hostile to human life. Mars, for instance, and the Saturnites, colonies which proved such a waste, and whose attempted settling helped bring your civilization to its mandibles. In our neighborhood, only the borstal at Mercury Station was permitted. You were harmless beings, so weak that we could squash you if need be whenever we so chose, but an amusing result of unspoiled evolution, and thus worthy enough to be allowed a fleeting existence. Now I see that in our condescension we allowed you great freedom. We believed there was nothing we did not see, but all senses are prisons, and we were as relatively blind as you. The system's Terran apes would surely self-destruct, leaving our superior forms to sail the wide fields and garden the flower gods in peace. It was only necessary to let the times blow of their own accord. Imagine the moment unforeseen when we were proved wrong, the terrible, incontrovertible fact. A small delegation of Terran life forms passed on an asteroid close to Venus, and one of these could, in his state of mind, see through the walls of his senses. But before we were able to interfere, he had managed to cement his new knowledge by analog wave to another. What could we do? There was no stable tradition, no programmed function to handle this anomaly. Nothing in history could prepare us for this moment. No such contact was written in any of the leaves of the pasts. We abandoned our Venus altogether to your history, through a crack in the air to another, safer system. Soon your Venusia appeared. Creatures were wandering like us between the winds, but with terrible and dangerous ignorance of their situation. Please, Rogers said, I'm too tired to follow. What does this matter? It was only after much thought that we began to understand the shocking truth. As hive historian, I myself was ordered to look into your species' past to explain our failure to predict your arrival. Like yourself, Mr. Collectibles, I enjoy this sort of work. the collecting and mapping, the harvesting of the sweet nectar of time's sexual organs. I immersed myself in your history, but it was to discover the secret of my own history, the contested origin of the 22. Our presence in so many time variants had made it impossible to trace our history to its beginnings and determine in which we might have first arose. What did it matter? We had always assumed a Venus, of course. There were many traditions suggesting it was this group, your own, where our home lay. Certain microbial creatures in the clouds, for instance, in this system, possessed genetics similar to ours. It occurred to me that an explanation of you might include your specific relation to insect life. The fact that, apparently, with your technology advanced to a type 1 state, you didn't need them anymore at all. Plants were engineered and science advanced enough so as to make insect life unnecessary. Pollination and atmospheric production were left to the machines. I'm sleeping. Eureka! Your relative hairlessness had left you with a fondness for silk, Mr. Rogers. One enterprising colonist brought with him a case of live Terran silkworms. Yes, 22 escaped. A tribe of 22 silkworms, Mr. Rogers, escaped captivity. They came upon some native mushrooms, and the rest, as they say, is history. Through an opening of the system's streams, they encountered the native cloud bugs of Venus and joined DNA to dine on Venusian fauna and survive millennia beyond your own extinction. They then redesigned their hairy husks and quantum minds to radically improve digestive and reproductive systems to inhabit and exploit the cracks between alternate system histories. We grew, spread our garden, laying many eggs to the queen in far and space-time. That's it? That's your story? From your perspective, of course, all this has not yet happened. But you are, in fact, my creator, Mr. Rogers, as I am yours. Melton's wandering brought us from our planet to the glory which makes the plants sing. It is with your minds that we first conquered our physics, as it was we, with other life forms, who created your world for you, and no god in your own image at all to encourage your growth. We Earthlings are all the same lifetime form, brother collectibles. You are our legs, and we are your hearts and minds. The great anal horn of the world worm presses all of its feces forward. We may not meet again, which is why I've gone to such lengths to explain these matters tonight. The green man has enveloped us in his circle, implicated us in his adolescent ape fantasy. Our future may never occur. Sailing with Cook to Tahiti, dining on human flesh, kneeling with Ortak in New Los Angeles, unleashing disease, weapons, and psychosexual disorder, the green man seeks to ruin all the shared Terran streams. It is certain, Mr. Collectibles, now I see it, that one of my kind was meant to make contact, to draw our histories down to one specific position on the game board, to parley and make a deal, force him to encounter our possible survivals. The queen remains ambivalent to such matters. Does this not give us hope? The minutes are numbered and a 14th Zarekian approaches from unseen reaches. I and you, Mr. Rogers, we have made together a kind of flower out of the dimensional intersection of our conversation, a parallax realometer of a better present. This conversation, this joining of mindstream is witnessed here as dream, but tomorrow when we meet in your Venusia, then we shall make real our arrangement. The green man will be exposed. And the bug took Rogers with miraculous gentleness in its hard and hairy arms. It carried him cradled through hallways, trapdoors, vine ladders, and trees to his adept. As it was laying him gently in his little home, tucking him in beneath the fluff, its words melted away. All I want, Rogers heard himself muttering, is to sell my book.
Thank you.
I have to make a correction. We don't exhale carbon monoxide.
So, carbon dioxide.
Isn't that good that we don't do that?
Our cars do.
Well, let's take a break and then come back and talk
Wonderful.
More about Venusia.
All right.